Michael Steele Podcast listeners. Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele Podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Michael Steele Podcast. And I want to re-engage in our conversation with Reginald Dwayne Betts and his new work, collection of poems, Felon, the memoir, A Question of Freedom. So you were talking about before we went to break, how a lot of times we don't come with honesty with about the situation, the circumstance, the condition, and you know, we're too tired and we're not willing to admit how tired we are. And that tiredness is probably related to, okay, here we go again, another scenario, another moment, another thing that's just like the one before it. And we sort of give up in the process, but you don't, and you didn't. You found a way, despite the circumstances, to pull yourself through this, and not give up and give in to the traditional notion that, well, this is all I can do, and I can go no further. How did you get to a point where you became comfortable enough to talk about your incarceration, to talk about that period, and to put it in words that, generationally speaking, will last time? I mean, that's the beauty of poetry, like a lot of different writing. It will speak in a different moment from now. How did you get comfortable creating that space?
You know, it's interesting because when I was in prison, so I got locked up in 1996, which is, you know, pre-laptop computer,
right,
pre-iPhone, basically pre-explosion of the internet. And I came home to a completely different world. But when I was inside, I expected to leave prison completely behind when I came home. Nobody was talking about prison reform, really, mm-hmm, in any kind of robust way that I heard while I was in prison, and my family wasn't hearing it. It just wasn't a subject of conversation. Virginia had got rid of parole like many other states in the early 90s and the mid 90s. And so I thought that I was in a time warp and that my duty was to do my time and survive and leave all of it behind me. I had no intention of ever talking about prison. I had an intention of going to college. I went to the University of Maryland. Like, I came home on March 4th, and April, I was in a counselor's office at University of Maryland. And he was like, I was like, yeah, I'm trying to enroll. And he said, okay, but, you know, we already got the class of 2009 chosen. And I was like, that's cool, because I want to go now. Remember, I got locked up my junior year of high school. So, right, I didn't even understand the language of a class, because I wasn't a part of the class. And he said, no, but we've already chosen even – you know, I was like, I want to start now. He was like, no, we've chosen the students. He was like, we're already in the second semester. I was a high school student the last time I was in school. I was like, what is a semester? You know?
Right. And he's sitting there looking at you like, why are you not getting what I'm saying? Right.
And then I get frustrated. And I say, you know what, man, look, I wasn't going to tell you this, but I just got out of prison. I got locked up when I was 16. I did 8 years. And I told my peoples I was going to go to college. I told myself I was going to go to college. So I'm here. And he looked at me and said, oh, how old are you? And I tell him, he said, well, look, you don't have to take the SAT test. I was like, that's not my biggest concern, you know?
On but the he list was like, of priorities.
Right. SAT. He was like, yeah, but you know, they only do the test in a certain time of year. And this means that since you don't have to take it, you could start in August. I was like, great, I could start here. He was like, no, you can't start here, but you can start at community college. And that's how I ended up going to community college, right? And so what happens is then I go to community college and I take this test and I test in an honors English, but you got to get a teacher to sign off on it. And I go to her class and she's like, her name is Dr. Melinda Frederick. Her name is Dr. Melinda Frederick. She says, yeah, for somebody who's so smart, why are you starting school so late? And I had wrote, the first article I wrote was about being a juvenile, about juveniles being locked up in prison with adults, and right, I published it, and I would carry it around with me just in case I needed to prove my intelligence. I thought having a published piece of writing proved something.
Right, right.
And so she says that, and I show her the piece, and I tell her, look, I was in prison, but, you know, I'm a writer, and I'm just trying to go to school. And she's like, you must have did something that was really crazy to go to prison at 16. And I was like, yeah, maybe. And so she signs the paper and I go to community college. And then I met Yao and I end up telling Yao. And again, I don't want to tell these people, but like, I was terrified in prison, but I stayed in general population. I met friends. I was loved in prison too. You know, I got a lot of friends that I met in prison. So I was just like, I wasn't willing to keep constantly erasing that past because it was, I didn't have anything to fill it with anyway. And I just didn't want to like run from it. And the last time I told somebody, I was in this class, I'm doing well, I got A's so far. It was Dr. Corey Haynes, and he taught African-American history. And I'm in his class, and this kid is giving all of these cliches about men in prison and about how we come home just to get locked back up again and how we like spreading diseases. And I was like, man, you don't know what you're talking about. And I didn't say it that politely either. I was just like,
I know you didn't.
And he was like, how personal. You know?
That point, it's personal, yeah.
And he was like, and mind you, the whole class is quiet now, you know? And honestly, I come home when I'm 24, but I'm in shape. 24 looks like 20, really, you know?
Right.
So they don't know me. And I say, because I just came home during 8 years. That's how I know. How you know? And then the professor was like, all right, calm down, folks. Let's move on. And then at the end of class, he was like, Mr. Betts, you mind staying after for a second? And I'm like, oh, they about to kick me out of college, you know? And he talks to me and he shares a bit of his story and how he had ran into a little bit of trouble when he went to community college and then went to Howard and then went to Oxford. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly, and he's telling me, you know, like you could do something with your life, no matter what somebody says. And he's like, you know, and you could actually talk about prison and do some good in the world too. And so all of that led to me being less afraid of talking about it in my personal life. And in my public life, I just met somebody. A classmate from middle school invited me to speak at her PhD class that she was teaching. Mm-hmm. She was a PhD student and was teaching a class at the University of Maryland. I go to speak at her class and I happen to meet Liz Ryan, mm-hmm. who ran a campaign for youth justice. And she heard me tell my story and was like, I think you should come talk to these folks. And then I ended up doing congressional briefings and, you know, speaking at different advocacy events. And I was with Charles S. Dutton and some other folks. I was featured in
my buddy brief. Charles. Yeah.
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 And we was in this amicus brief for Graham v. Florida that said that you can't send a juvenile to prison for life. I faced life. And it's like you can't send a juvenile to prison for life for a non-homicide offense. Mm-hmm. And so all of that's to say that it wasn't planned. I thought I was going to come home and go to college and be a writer. And I didn't know what that meant. And then I thought when I learned a little bit more that I would teach poetry, none of that stuff panned out. Never planned on going to law school, but, you know, opportunities came and I kept trying to find a way to pivot when sort of opportunities didn't pan out. And going to law school, in fact, was me just like pivoting from not being able to get a job, not even being able to get an interview on the teaching market. I just decided if I was going to be an unemployed convict, I might as well be an unemployed convict with a Harvard law degree.
Join the ranks of those other Harvard lawyers without a job.
And then I went to Yale. I went to Yale because I was like, Yale is going to ensure that I get a job.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in 2019, you win the National Magazine Award in the Essays and Criticism category for Getting Out, which was the essay that you did that really documented your journey from prison to becoming an attorney. You also had the work that I was curious about. It was Bastards of the Reagan Era. So let's set the record straight. as a Black Republican, I am of the Reagan Era. So I just want to make sure I get my bastard credentials on correctly. What was that about? What was the nature of that?
But it wasn't really like, so a lot of times it's interesting too, because we think about, you know, and bastards being like fatherless children. Yeah. But in fact, the Bastards of the Reagan Era, like my dad, I was born in 80. Mm-hmm. So that's the Reagan Era. But truly, the sort of fatherlessness that I'm talking about, and actually like the unmoored lack of community that I'm talking about in terms of these narratives, they come in a generation that would be like my children, really.
Right.
They come in a generation that I was writing that when I was teaching in Southeast D.C. at Hart Middle School. And one of the things I was grappling with was that I was of a generation where a lot of my friends, myself included, our fathers weren't around. But then I think I came home to that being you know, repeating in some kind of way. But I wasn't trying to just talk about fatherlessness, right? I had been at a museum and I saw that they call it an elephant graveyard, but it's not really elephant graveyard because elephants ain't moving their bones anywhere. Right. And they found the same thing with woolly mammoths. And what it is when it's like some huge disaster that's about to happen, the reason why you find all of these giant animals in the same place is because they circle the young.
That's right.
And when a disaster falls, it hits everybody. Man, wasn't nobody arguing that I shouldn't go to prison because I got the potential of being a Yale lawyer?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody. And it wasn't just like and my family was arguing, but they weren't necessarily equipped with the narratives that explained it because they had been beaten over their head with the narratives of lack and with the narratives of impossibility as well. But what I really am saying is the Bastards of Reagan era was this generation of young folks who, in the face of really challenging circumstances, and this is not about saying accountability should be thrown to the wind.
Right.
This is about saying that nobody ever told me I could be me.
Right.
And right. We should be ashamed of that. Forget right. the fact that because the way people try to make it better by saying I'm an exception. Well, like I'm not an exception.
Right.
I am just the one that I'm talking about my teachers when I was a high school student at Suitland High School was predicting that I was going to end up dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I had like internal resources and a good household. Imagine what they said to people who had none of those
nothing,
things.
Right.
You know, and right. so the story, it didn't even a critique of like, you know, Black Reaganites, you know, right. It's not a critique of conservatives.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
You know, some people think it is though. And right. they think it is. But if you read, well, I mean, you'll see in a poem, The Invention of Crack, I talk about how complex it is because it is the folks in the Black community that is calling it a scourge. And it is a really complicated issue. I mean, some of my folks, you know, succumb to drug addiction. And so like when Biggie say, yeah, call the police on me, I was just trying to feed my family. I'm like, I don't know. You was trying to, you know, you was trying to ruin my family with drugs. You know, it's more complicated than just, you know, somebody calling the police on you because you was trying to feed your family. So with that collection of poems, I try to explore it in its complication like I do with all of my work.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
The Sports Psychology Hour with Dr. Andrew Jacobs is a conversation about success in sports and life, coaching, youth sports, and so much more. Listen to athletes, coaches, parents, and just ordinary folks like you who want to achieve and have fun doing it. Now you can support the show at patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. Get access to ad-free content and exclusive Patreon-only episodes. Just go to patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. That's patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.